You're listening to an audio podcast sponsored by the Carnegie Council, the voice for ethics in international affairs, online at www.carnegiecouncil.org. The following U.S. Global Engagement Program was recorded on March 9, 2010. It features Craig Charney, Nicholas Gostev, Parag Khanna, Devon Stewart, and Stephen Young speaking on Rise of the Rest 3, Climate Change, Energy, and the Global Governance After the Financial Crisis. We hope you enjoy the program.
I'm Devon Stewart from the Carnegie Council. Welcome, welcome everyone. Welcome, friends and colleagues and supporters. This is the Rise of the Rest 3. We started this theme in 2007 at the Nixon Center with Nick Vajdev, who's right here, who is now based in Newport, Rhode Island. We have people coming from all over the country on this panel, and it's really I'm just so excited about this. And this is actually I teach at NYU part time, and I named my class after this panel, which is the theme that Fareed Zakaria came up with to describe the rise of China and India and the BRICS, the so-called BRICS, and now the BRICS include Indonesia, so it's the BRICS or the BRICIs, or BRICI maybe in the Italian pronunciation. The Bici, right. So this is really cool, I'm just can't wait to have this exciting panel here. And I want to make a quick plug and turn it over to our new colleague here, David Pratt. If ethics matter to you, please support our program here. This is an ongoing program that we're really cutting edge and doing really pioneering ethics in international affairs. Nothing quite like it. So if you feel good about supporting ethics, this is definitely a sound investment. So here is David Pratt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Devon. I'll be really quick. As Devon said, my name is David Pratt. I am the Carnegie Council's new Director of Development. So it's great that Devon talked about supporting us. That was the perfect segue. We are offering some brand new ways to support us by co-hosting, hosting, or dedicating events like this, dedicating as an honoring someone with an event like this. So we have at long last come up with the answer to the question, what do you give the person who has everything? You give them an event at the Carnegie Council, which might involve a speaker you're particularly interested in or they're interested in, subject matter that they are particularly interested in, and so on. So anyone can see me after the event if you would like to talk about that. And I also have information on our newly formed Friends Committee, which is a kind of inner advisory circle Joel will be working with in the years ahead as we move toward our centennial and expand our programming for that. So here is some of that programming now. Thanks to everyone on the panel and everyone who's come here today. Have a terrific time.
Thank you much, David. And I'm going to pass the baton over to the other David in the Carnegie Council staff, David Speedy, Senior Fellow of the Global Engagement Program. David, take it away. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Devon. Let me join Devon and the other David in welcoming everyone here. It's always a pleasure to see a mix of old and new faces at the Council, especially the new, I have to say. But anyhow, welcome everyone. As Devon said, I will be brief because we have a truly formidable panel here and, of course, all too little time. But let me just say that, as Devon said, this series on Rise of the Rest goes back almost 3 years to an event in D.C. with, at that time, an even more dramatic title than we have today. The title then was A World Without the West. And in a related article at that time in the National Interest, Stephen Weber was quoted. Steve is the director of the Carl Berkeley Institute for International Studies, and he said, U.S. and European officials and experts tend to see the rest of the world's policy choices through the distorted lens of U.S. hegemony, so they have failed to give proper consideration to significant developments elsewhere. And our Rise of the Rest series, of which this is the third iteration, has examined both sides of that rather dramatic proposition. First of all, the emergence, which seems reasonable, of an important group of states for whom Western ideas have little resonance or relevance, and perhaps even more dramatic for us sitting in New York, the waning, the decline of U.S. Western power of influence, the corollary of that proposition. So last year, Devon, in the second conference here, spoke of the different ways in which this could be termed. The Rise of the Rest, The World Without the West Again, The Second World, or The Post-American World. All of these are terms that we wrestle with and try to parse. And if we think this is overly hyperbolic or over-dramatic, Devin, I guess this comes under the category of success has a thousand parents and failure is an orphan, but the Financial Times actually gives the credit for the acronym BRIC to the chief economist of Goldman Sachs, Jim O'Neill. And in this article, a recent article in the Financial Times, it says, quote, that O'Neill has redrawn the power broker's cognitive map, helping them to articulate a fundamental shift of influence away from the Western world. So this is this is serious stuff in the corridors of power, and at the very least, what we're looking at here in this series is the proposition that the economic, military, political activity away from non-Western states, among non-Western states, is increasing more rapidly than that between the U.S. and the West and those non-Western states. Last year, we emphasized in the last conference, the economic activity, but clearly the economic rearrangements are being paralleled in security political arrangements, and I'll put in a little plug, if I may. If you check our website, we posted an article recently on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Russia, China, and four of the Central Asian states. And with India, Pakistan, and Iran having observer status, this is clearly an organization that was regarded somewhat as a somewhat frivolous, if not irrelevant, organization when it was funded about a decade ago. And clearly, we argue, is now somewhat more than that. And so the conversation continues. And today, we are gathered to discuss Rise of the Rest 3, Climate Change, Energy, and Global Governance After the Financial Crisis, which I suppose raises the question, what do we do after the first 20 minutes of this discussion? That's a fairly broad agenda. And we have a truly remarkable panel. I won't go into all the details of bios, but we have a leading pollster with a highly knowledgeable on such matters as failed states, religious extremism, intergroup conflict, democracy promotion, who has worked both for Bill Clinton and for Nelson Mandela. We have a professor of national security studies at the Naval War College and a senior fellow of strategic studies at the Nixon Center in Washington. We have an author of 6 books on what's called the Second World, and the head of the Core Round Table, an organization, a network of business leaders. So we have so many different interests and backgrounds represented here. I'd like to start with, at the end of the table, Nick Gwozdev, an old friend of this session. Nick is the Professor of National Security Studies at the Naval War College, Senior Editor of National Interest Magazine, and a former Senior Fellow of Strategic Studies at the Nixon Center in Washington, D.C. Nick has been at all of these events so far. He's the continuity factor, and so I invite him to open our session. Thank you.
Thank you, David. David mentioned the article in the National Interest from several years ago that got the ball rolling on this discussion, and this is the third session that we're holding on this general topic. And for those of you that were not here for our last session in July of 2008, if you give me a few minutes, I'll bring you up to where we were then and how it paves the way for our discussion today. Starting with, it's important to look at the world without the West thesis that Weber and his colleagues advanced. And this argument has been caricatured a lot as the development of a large anti-American alliance in the world that would range against the U.S. and seek to counterbalance it. And that wasn't the initial thrust of the argument. The thrust was, instead, not that countries are looking to oppose the United States necessarily, but they're looking for ways to route around the United States. They're looking for ways in which questions of global and regional concern could be discussed and settled without all roads having to lead through Washington. Or perhaps not all roads leading not only to Washington, but to New York and Brussels and London as well. That is, to have a greater convergence of the countries of the non-Western world, or however we choose to define it, coming together and not necessarily having to accept the agenda as it was being set by the United States or by the United States in Europe. Back then, this argument attracted a lot of attention. And then between July of 2008 and today, we've had a number of developments in the world that led a number of people to say, well, this argument of the world without the West really didn't have any legs to it. And the first, of course, was the impact of the global financial crisis, which you had particularly in Washington, was arguments that the problems being experienced around the world would cause other nations to reappreciate and reevaluate the need for U.S. leadership. There would be a return to American leadership in the global community of nations, and that the financial crisis would also take away some of the capabilities, some of the strengths that the countries that formed the world without the West were beginning to accrue. And in particular, this was an argument focused on Russia, but to some extent on China as well, that the financial crisis essentially would be a devastating challenge to the resiliency of the political and economic systems of Russia and China and of some of the other rising powers. It would reiterate the importance of the Washington Consensus, and you would sort of see a move away or back from state capitalism towards models that were then more in vogue in the West. The idea being that the financial crisis would kick in the door and the whole rotten structure of the world without the West would come tumbling down, and countries would sort of flock back to the Euro-Atlantic banner. The second, of course, was that a lot of people predicted that the election of Barack Obama in the United States to the presidency was going to somehow reinvigorate American global leadership, that simply by the fact that you no longer had George W. Bush in the White House, this would cause countries around the world to reassess their attitudes towards the U.S. and global leadership, and all you needed was a fresh face at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and the world without the West again would vanish away. To some extent, there were some truths to this. The financial crisis did shake the economies and the political systems of countries around the world, but not simply the countries of the world without the West, but also within the West itself. There has been a change of tone in Washington that has been appreciated in other countries, and that has borne some fruits. And finally, the outgoing George W. Bush administration recognized the need to widen the circle and made a fateful decision in trying to cope with the global crisis, which was to dispense with the G8 and substitute the G20, the Group of 20, as the premier forum for discussing key questions around the health and maintenance of the global economy. And then this process has been continued in the Obama administration. And another set of events that we used to have here, which was to always evaluate the impacts of the G8 summits, perhaps we'll have a series of events now looking at whether or not the G20 will do a better job than the G8 has done in terms of addressing some of these questions. But it's also clear that from our perspective here in March of 2010, that the world without the West idea, the post-American century, the rise of the West, that that these processes have not been interrupted, that they're continuing, that they're ongoing, and that these are concepts we need to continue to tackle in the years ahead. Sitting here in July of 2008, I had said that there were going to be four dialogues that were critical to how the world order would be shaped in the coming decade. And I identified the four as being the U.S.-China dialogue, the dialogue between Russia and the Europeans, the dialogue between India and China, and the dialogue between the southern democracies among themselves, and then the dialogue of the southern democracies with the others, with Russia and China, with the United States and Europe. And how these four dialogues worked out would do a lot to determine how the global order would evolve, how it would take shape. because of the interest of time, I'm not really going to look at how dialogues one and two are shaping. If people have questions about that, we can entertain that in the questions and answers. What I'd like to do is to focus primarily on dialogues three and four, the India-China dialogue and the dialogue around the southern democracies. And if we look at this, we can see that the world without the West concept still has a number of legs to it. We saw this at Copenhagen, where the southern democracies lined up with China to sort of stand against the consensus being put forward by the developed West. So you have now what are called the basic countries, Brazil, South Africa, India, and China, working to set a common platform on climate change. You have Brazil emerging more as not only a regional leader, but beginning to take its first steps on the global arena, and it's not automatically in line with what the U.S. expects. If you look at the 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review that was just issued, there is an assumption that we have that southern democracies, India in particular, which is mentioned at several points in the QDR, but also other southern democracies, Indonesia, Brazil, and others, will somehow automatically line up with the United States when it comes to questions of global governance, that it's really a split between autocracy and democracy in the global arena. And the realities are is that the southern democracies are still, as Harry Harding said in the panel in July of 2008, they're the global independents. They don't really adhere necessarily to one side or the other. Brazil has shown an interest. It works with the United States, but then took a lead in the summit that we just had in Cancun with the community of Latin America, which the United States and Canada were specifically not invited to take part. And to the extent that Brazil feels that the OAS process is deadlocked and has issues with the United States, it's been willing to route around the United States and to try to encourage other countries in the hemisphere to do the same. So it'll be interesting to see what the trajectory of this new community will be. Brazil and India, of course, have also worked to strengthen their relationship in a number of areas, which, again, points to their desire to see greater reform of global governance, more towards their concerns. The IBSA Forum, which, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, was usually dismissed a few years ago as something other than just window dressing or a nice photo opportunity. IBSA, which is the India-Brazil-South Africa Forum, not only is working to coordinate a common position on the Doha Round and on trade issues, but has taken its first forays into security policy, particularly with regards to securing the Indian and Atlantic Oceans, or at least having a role in keeping the global commons of that part of the sea space open and working together and doing maneuvers and joint activities. The BRIC, even if Russia is seen by some as not fulfilling the criteria economically of being in the BRIC anymore, the BRIC summits continue. The next one will take place in April in Brasilia. Brazil, Russia, India, and China will once again convene a summit meeting. And again, looking at the BRIC, it's important not to fall into the trap of saying, well, this must be some kind of, if it's not a cohesive, you know, alliance where all four countries are in lockstep together, then you know, it's not succeeding. What the BRIC and why it's been working over the last several years with these summits is not that all four countries line up and come to a common position, but it's the fact that they're coordinating their activities together and that they use each other as force multipliers to increase their collective bargaining position in institutions of global governance to be able to put the four of them together. They recognize that that then gives them some clout at the table because the BRIC essentially counterbalance the Euro-Atlantic world in terms of economic heft in the world, but also military and security power. When you sort of see the four of them together, it enables them to make a claim to be able to credibly speak for half the planet, just as traditionally the G7 group of countries usually spoke on behalf of at least half the planet. So that forum continues, and certainly the Brazilian foreign minister, Amorim, has been one of the ones to really push this concept forward and to keep it moving forward. And so we do have these embryonic groupings of countries which are saying, well, if you know the U.S. leadership doesn't produce the outcomes that we want, or U.S. leadership is insufficient to breaking the deadlock in existing international groupings, then we can go around them. And that has not ended or stopped as a result of the financial crisis. It has not ended or stopped simply because President Obama was elected. This is an ongoing process, and it continues. And the reality is that, as we're seeing now, and as I think we'll see for the forthcoming future, it is beginning to realign the balance of power in global institutions to a point where the United States and Europe, which in the past had a sense that they could set an agenda and other countries would more or less have to conform to it, you're now seeing much more of an approach of horse trading, where the ability of Washington, Brussels, and then London, Paris, Berlin, and Tokyo, among others, to more or less accept that they can set a global agenda and that Beijing, Moscow, Brasilia, New Delhi, Jakarta, and others will somehow have to learn to live with it, is now becoming more, well, what can we trade and how can we go back and forth? And that will produce some challenges, I think, for those who expected that the age of Obama was going to lead to a return to American global primacy as it did in earlier eras.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. That was a marvelously comprehensive and concise assessment of the sort of rearrangement of the cards, as it were, in new alliances. I think the important thing is this question you pointed out at the end, that this is not some sort of cohesive alliance of countries working in lockstep, but it's not an us versus them. Back to your point at the beginning, this is not specifically an anti-US or anti-Western phenomenon. It's simply an evolving, emerging, embryonic, again, to use your word, a sense of a new world order that that we pay attention to. I am told that you do have this detailed list of bios, so I will not do what moderators usually do and say someone needs no introduction and then introduce them for 15 minutes. I'll merely turn over now to Craig Charney, our good friend here at the Council. And Craig is the pollster in our group, so Craig, how's this playing out?
Well, I'm going to be speaking today, David, about some of the four mega trends, really, that are helping to drive the processes of change that Nick was talking about. And these are all around two basic themes, around integration and disintegration. Specifically, I'll be looking at issues relating to democracy, connectedness, collective responsibility, and national power. All of these are playing out in ways that are helping to drive the rise of the rest and helping to shape it, as well as its interactions with the developed West. So to begin with democracy. Now, increasingly, it's quite clear, I think, that there is an international consensus among peoples themselves in favor of elected and accountable leadership in some sort. Now, we have, my firm and I have literally polled from Afghanistan to Zululand, and in the Far East and in Latin America as well. And we've asked a couple of questions, and we get very consistent answers. One is, what does democracy mean to you? And the answer is, almost everywhere, freedom or free expression. And the answer is, why do you want to vote in an election? This is particularly important because we make our living, in part, either in election campaigns or voter education campaigns. When we ask, why do you want to vote in this election, people tell us to choose our leaders. That may seem awfully banal, but in places where people have not been able to choose their leaders, it is a big thing. Even in a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, a rich society, a society where people will tell you that most people say that the country is headed in the right direction, where the king is exceedingly popular, you will still have people tell you by a very large majority that they would prefer to live in a democracy to a country that is led by a strong leader. At the same time, though, while this consensus is very broad, it is not very deep. It's what I might call a minimalist consensus in favor of democracy. Because the key, as I said, is some form of electoral accountability, the opportunity to choose leaders. By that standard, Russia, Afghanistan, Venezuela, and even perhaps Iran would all qualify, since most people in those places would say they did have a choice among leaders. In other words, it's not what we in the West would necessarily call a demand for free and fair elections or for full democracy and democratization. for example, in Russia, by more than a 2-to-1 majority, people preferred, or at least until recently, preferred the sort of strong leader that they had to a more democratic system, though there are some signs that that may be starting to change. Still, the desire to choose one's own leaders is a very powerful trend at present. Second, connectedness. Here I may be stating the obvious, but I don't think we think about the implications often enough. The first is TV and radio. These have become the integuments of the states of our time, and across the states as well. In the case of TV, most people have heard of Al Jazeera, which most people in the Arab world watch for their news. But even at the national level, TV has become a key factor in knitting nations together. Whether you were to look at India, whether you were to look at Pakistan, where 65% of people watch TV nightly, even if you look in a place like Afghanistan, where only the people in the towns get TV, 70% of people listen to the radio at least 4 times a week for their news, usually the BBC or Voice of America. Why? Well, in Afghanistan, for the last 30 years, knowing the latest news has often been a matter of life and death. So, to use Benedict Anderson's phrase, what we're seeing is the emergence of imagined communities, both the reinforcement of national sentiment by stronger connections to electronic media, much stronger than those that print media exercised in their heyday when Ben was writing about it, or of transnational communities that are emerging through transnational television systems like that of Al Jazeera. However, even broader in its reach than the television networks has been the rise of telephones. Now, just 10 years ago, in 2000, only 15% of families had access to telephones. That's 15%. This year, 70% of humanity lives in a family with a telephone. Obviously, it's been driven by the rise of cell phones, but this is the fastest transformation in communications in the history of humankind. It means that people have myriads, literally billions of possibilities for communication, which did not exist 10 years ago. The implications are staggering for collective awareness and action, whether we're talking about the flow of news, whether we're talking about markets, whether we're talking about the expression of social wants or the formation of social movements. And soon, certainly in 10 years, probably in much less, the way most of the world is going to get on the internet is not through wired machines, not even through Nick Negroponte's $100 laptop. It's through the machines you have in your pockets when they are sold and remaindered in the developing countries. So connectedness is already tying people to their fellow countrymen, reaching across borders, establishing communities, and soon we'll have the whole world on the internet. Third, collective responsibility. The notion of global stewardship is a very important one, and I think one which is being driven in turn by the rise of connectedness. My colleague John Zogby has written, I think, very eloquently in his book, The Way Will Be, about the emergence of what he calls global citizens. And while he focuses on them in the U.S., he and others have also written about their emergence in the Arab world, in Russia, and elsewhere. And here we're talking about the generation that's generally referred to as millennials, young people who are less nationalistic, who are less tied to traditional loyalties, who are more liberal in their political and economic outlook, more multilateralist, and more concerned about global problems. And to some extent, their views are echoed by the emerging middle classes of whatever age throughout the developing world. We see this coming through in very interesting ways if we look at issues, for example, like global warming. In countries like Russia and India and China, or in countries like Pakistan and Egypt, the public is way ahead of their government on environmental issues. For example, in all the countries I've mentioned, more than 4/5 of the public say that they're very concerned about pollution, and over 2/3 in each country sees global warming as a serious problem. Even more startling, in these countries, substantial majorities would accept reduced growth and employment in order to solve environmental problems. So we see that this is actually starting to translate into a consensus in favor of environmental action, one that has not fully been implemented by governments, obviously, as the chaos at Copenhagen showed, but one for which there is a growing and increasingly important audience. Now, there are limitations to this. There are limitations to how far people would be willing to pay higher prices, for example, in order to support environmental action abroad as well as here. But it's real. Finally, national power. At various places, people always say it is national power, national jealousies, national rivalries, national economies which matter the most. And certainly, jealousy over sovereignty remains a defining feature of the 21st century world. So does lingering anti-imperialist resentment in many developing countries. And something that we see this reflected in is the changing international pecking order, if you prefer, the changing international balance of power. This is partly reflected in the Pew polls. Andy Cohen has spoken from this panel, or from this platform, rather, on the important how different nations are regarded. If you look at the most recent poll, some of the findings are quite striking. In Western Europe, for example, the U.S. is more favorably regarded than either China or Russia. Although, interestingly enough, in Spain, the EU is preferred to the U.S. And in the U.K., China actually edges out the EU in terms of regard, which might amuse some British Euroskeptics. Latin Americans tend to view the world a bit like we do, a bit like the Europeans. They, too, prefer America to either China or Russia or the EU. On the other hand, if you look at some of the developing countries, things look a bit different. Thus, for example, China is preferred to both Russia and the EU and is seen more favorably by the U.S. by more than 2-1 in Egypt. And similarly, in India, while attitudes towards the U.S. are very positive, China is considerably better viewed than is the European community. So we see that there are some very important differences in the way the rise of China has impacted perceptions and international admiration, soft power, if you will. On the other hand, if we disaggregate the question of international power, things do look a little different. If you ask people what it is they admire about China, you hear things about their rapid development, increasing economic power, and national pride. On the other hand, if you ask people, interestingly enough, even people who on balance are unfavorable to the U.S., what is it they admire about the U.S., and you get a rather long list. Science, technology, education, the economy, the legal system, the work ethic. The U.S. is the country that ought to lead the global fight against global warming. Our movies and culture are widely appreciated, even by people who formerly looked down on them. Indeed, I remember once being in a focus group watching a focus group in Morocco where a group of older men were disparaging American movies and culture as trash, and then one of them turned to the others and said, "Let's get serious. Is there anyone here who'd really want to go watch a French movie instead of an American one?" And much as I have to admit that I've had a crush on Gong Li for years, I hope my wife's not watching this, I think that if one was honest, one would have to say that Meryl Streep has a much wider global audience. In addition, though, to the changing national balance of power, there's also the importance of the national identity and its protection. And Andy's figures from the most recent Pew survey are very interesting when it comes to the protection of national identity, specifically on the protection of our national way of life against foreign influence. And 69% of Russians say that that's important to them. Interestingly enough, the same proportion of Americans who do, 69%. The figures, however, are even higher in some of the emerging powers. 81% of Chinese, 93% of Indians, 83% of Mexicans, 78% of Indonesians express anxiety for the protection of their national culture against the globally integrative influences. And, you know, the phenomenon of rallying around the flag is one we've seen very powerfully, whether it occurred during the Russian invasion of Georgia 2 years ago, or the incidents in China of mass protests after the U.S. accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 2000, or more recently, the clash over the forcing down of a U.S. surveillance aircraft. So I'm not trying to suggest that any of these forces are linear or all point in the same direction, or even that integration will necessarily win out over disintegration or vice versa. But I think the four forces I've just spoken about, namely democracy, collective responsibility, connectedness, and national power, are the four of the key variables that are going to help drive the dynamics of the countries and the systems that Nick was talking about and that are our subject today.
Thank you, Craig. We native Brits are just malcontents, as you know, so the data it's just a protest vote. Don't take it too seriously. I hope that in the Q&A, perhaps, this question, you spoke about soft power, Chinese soft power, and I hope that comes up, perhaps, because clearly it's a very relevant topic here, and I hope it might come up in the audience exchange. Parag Khanna is Director of Global Governance Initiative at the New America Foundation in Washington. And Parag, you were here last, I think, to talk about your book,
That's right.
The Second World. So welcome back.
Thank you very much. In fact, Nick's remarks made me very nostalgic because back in 2004, before we talked about the rest or the world without the West or the BRICS, I was already very uncomfortable with the assumption of American primacy and continued hegemony. And so on a modest budget from Random House, I set out to travel through many of the countries that come up when we talk about the rest. And the result is the book, The Second World, which profiles about 35 of them. And really the focus was to emphasize the connections among them that are taking place without the supervision or control of Washington, London, Paris, Moscow, and so forth. So what I really wanted to get at there is this multi-alignment. Multi-alignment is this practice of everyone making connections with anyone, however they can, to advance their own interests, irrespective of any deference to American authority or dominance. And that really is the diffusion of diplomacy. And the diffusion of diplomacy away from traditional either state or intergovernmental institutions and structures is the crisis of global governance. So now I want to bring this to that level of what we think about when we talk about global governance today. And that crisis of global governance really predates, of course, this financial crisis. If anything, if you think about it, having everyone tuning in to the G20 summits that have taken place over the last year and a half, those summits are the ones that have given people hope that there can be some functional global governance. Some people say the Sherpas of the G20 are the ones who saved the world from financial collapse by negotiating the global bailout packages and so forth. And yet still, of course, global governance is very much in crisis. I'll come back to the G20 later because I certainly don't agree that it is going to be able to govern the world. The crisis of global governance, very fundamentally, that we have been in and continue to be in, is a crisis of power, a crisis of norms, and a crisis of institutions. It's a crisis of power because these rising powers, again, whether you call them the Second World or the rest or emerging markets and so forth, they do not have the voice in the existing structures that we think of as being the global governors. Take the UN Security Council, for example, and the debate over the need to expand it, but the lack of expansion of that body. To this day, on the 38th floor of the United Nations, there is no good proposal that has substantial buy-in as to how and when to expand the UN Security Council. Take the International Monetary Fund and the voting shares and rights on the board of the IMF. Also, very slow progress on that. I'll come back to the IMF in a minute as well. Again, the crisis of global governance is also a crisis of norms. What should the rules be? Intellectual property rights? Well, now that China has joined the WTO, good luck. Democracy as a priority for global institutions to pursue and even for American foreign policy? Very much in debate. Now we talk about state capitalism as a rival model, and China as being the sort of the strongest embodiment of that. What about humanitarian intervention versus sovereignty? Again, very, very strong ideological debates around that as well. And so the crisis of global governance, the third argument, is also a crisis of institutions. How or why can we even continue to have central institutions? When people think about the future of global governance, they're incredibly unimaginative, to be honest. If all we're talking about is reforming the post-World War II architecture, how does that capture the diffusion of diplomacy that I was talking about? It doesn't, and it can't. And that is the point that I think really needs to be addressed. That's what I would call meta-global governance, thinking about how we think about global governance rather than assuming the existing architecture just needs to be tinkered with a little bit. Is it even possible? I'm not even so sure. And if you look around the world at what successes that do exist in transnational governance, the highest level you can really point to across a robust set of issues would be the regional level. Of course, you'd point to the European Union first and foremost. The European Union works for Europe. A lot of people think it could potentially work as a larger model, but there are no structures for that. But you do have efforts in Asia to create the ASEAN Plus 3, ASEAN Regional Forum, East Asian Community. Some even talk about an Asian Union in Africa. They are calling it the African Union in Latin America, the Union of South American Nations. The usage of the word union is not accidental here. There is an iconic sort of dimension to the way in which the European Union has succeeded, even though no other region will probably ever come close to what they've achieved. The fact is the efforts at diminishing conflict, at addressing regional issues of concern through regional institutions is far more successful than most of what we could point to on the global level. Global mechanisms may be desirable. It brings a certain simplicity and parsimony that we're all, you know, looking for when we want to say, that's global governance, those guys there in that room. It doesn't work that way anymore. I'd say climate change is perhaps the best example from today's world of how that's just not happening. Again, Kyoto, Bali, Copenhagen, later this year, Mexico City. If you want high emissions, high polluting climate tourism, no better way to go about it than to take the standard global governance track of climate diplomacy. It's not working. Instead, there's a robust set of activities going on at the regional, the interregional, the bilateral level, public-private partnerships, all sorts of things that you can't just grab with one hand and say, aha, this is the global governance. But in my opinion, that's okay. And poverty, also, it's very much the same. Chanting about global poverty, as many people do, when they want to raise mega funds at the United Nations to deal with the crisis that poor countries face, is again a very simple way of pretending that you can have a central solution, but it doesn't really work and it doesn't really motivate. In fact, there's a Latin American variant of the poverty problem, an African variant, and a South Asian variant, and so on, and they're all very different. There are certain triggers, let's say, or levers, like the issue of subsidies, farm subsidies, and trade restrictions, and so forth, that, if managed right, could have a global impact on poverty. But there's exactly in that domain where there's no movement whatsoever. When was the last time you heard Europeans or Americans say that they were really going to cut their subsidies to a substantial degree? So all of the success is happening around what we think of as the legitimate existing global governance architecture. So the crisis of global governance is definitely one of globality, the notion that there is a global that is really working and motivating and pushing people. And the central institution for decades in the debate about global governance has been the United Nations. But as I've described the proliferation of regionalism and all of these other mechanisms, clearly multilateralism is not synonymous with the United Nations. And beyond that, the United Nations is no longer one monolithic entity. It never really was. But people were able to say, oh, let's go back to the United Nations. I think you heard Barack Obama say that during the presidential campaign. And as if it were so simple, say, aha, we'll just go back and channel our diplomatic influence and we'll partner with the UN. But there is no one UN. Depends really on what you want to get done, whether or not the UN is going to be helpful to you or some part of the UN is or is not going to be helpful. There are the core organs, the UN Security Council, the General Assembly, the Secretariat, that most consider utterly dysfunctional and beyond repair. And Ban Ki-moon, in his diplomatic way, has more or less said that, even on the record. He even said about the Secretariat, no one is quite really sure what it does. That tells you something. If the main bodies that most people do identify as being representative of the United Nations are completely beyond repair, that's a bad sign. But I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I would say that there are functional agencies of the UN, UNICEF, the World Food Program, and others that really shine through. They really get the job done. They are a last line of defense. There are more peacekeepers active under United Nations auspices today than ever before. They do prevent thousands, millions of unnecessary deaths. They are very important. They deserve the Nobel Prizes that they have won over the last 50 years. There's also the Bretton Woods bodies, which people don't think of necessarily belonging to the UN, even though they were created around the same time, the IMF and the World Bank. Sure, you can put more money into the IMF, you can put more money into the World Bank, but are they really the central organs of governing global financial management or dealing with economic development? No, not really. You are only as powerful as the money that you have. Who has the money makes the rules. And the IMF, most of its clients are European, and the World Bank, most of its clients are, of course, in Africa. So what is global governance based on this fragmentation and diffusion that I'm describing? Global governance is the sum of multilateral bodies, so the UN and Bretton Woods and so forth, the proliferating regional mechanisms that exist, again, African Union, European Union, and so forth, the inter-regional sort of functional activities that are out there, and again, the number of different bilateral climate treaties and cooperation, the proliferation security initiative to counter the spread of nuclear material, or the anti-piracy task force that has assembled with dozens of countries in the Indian Ocean. Those are also examples of this ad hoc functional multilateralism that is part of global governance. And then there's this huge, almost utterly unquantifiable now array of public-private relationships. You think of the Gates Foundation, of the Open Society Institute, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, the World Economic Forum, the Amnesty International, the list goes on and on and on. All of those entities and actors form partnerships with each other, with governments, with international agencies. That, too, is part of this new multilateralism that really constitutes global governance. So global governance has no center. And what you have to turn on your head is this notion that because we're talking about global governance, we're talking about some central institutions. In fact, for global governance to work in the future and to be able to capture the totality of globalization and how globalization has empowered all these different actors, you have to think about global governance as being radically decentralized. So where does that leave multilateral organizations, the ones that we do think of traditionally as being part of global governance? They have to really just find their niche. Development institutions like the World Bank, in my opinion, really need to focus not on having offices in Brazil and Russia and countries that are trillion-dollar economies, but really on, and this is a sort of paternalistic kind of term, but on adopting the countries that are orphans, that are not getting foreign investment, that don't have robust aid programs from bilateral donors, that quite simply do not have the resources of their own to develop themselves. On climate, as I mentioned earlier, we should be letting 1,000 different instruments bloom in a way, because you're not going to have global regulation handed down from the Copenhagen process. It will not happen. If you wait for it, the world will end. And then to bring it to the final issue and bring it back to the G20, global financial management. The G20 is good, but it's definitely insufficient. It isn't the so-called steering committee for the world that many people make it out to be. It can, at best, manage to maintain some consensus among 20 or more key economies on reining in protectionism and on maintaining fiscal stimulus to the extent that is a good thing to keep the global economy stable. But it cannot solve the Iran issue, the Israeli-Palestine issue, climate change, and everything else that many people would now like to dump on its agenda. It isn't qualified or capable to do that. There's a difference between international cooperation and international coordination and collaboration. The G20 is not a legal body. It is an informal coordinating platform. That's all it is. It cannot make legally binding decisions, and we have to be mindful of that. I would certainly suggest that we try and form more networks of Sherpas, of diplomats who are the key figures and key experts and have the ear of national leadership on climate, on poverty, on nuclear proliferation, and so forth, and get those going and try to make progress on those issues. And it wouldn't look like, it wouldn't necessarily be the same G20 countries. You don't need Argentina at the table when you're talking about nuclear proliferation. But you do need Indonesia there, as it is in the G20, when it comes to climate change. So these more ad hoc sorts of networks are most certainly the way to go, but we shouldn't confuse that future with just assuming that the G20 is the new United Nations, the G20 is the new steering committee for the world, the G20 can run the world. I think that would be grossly misunderstanding what globalization has done to global governance and therefore charting the wrong path forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Perun. I was particularly struck by your "Let 1,000 instruments bloom." I guess it's because of my contaminated by my background as a foundation program officer. We always tend to want to sort of glom things together, you know, and so, again, perhaps in conversation with the audience, we can get into this less ad hoc, or the question of a more ad hoc and formal network of Sherpas and so on and so forth. It's a very interesting conceptual challenges we face as New World Order. Okay, batting cleanup. We have Stephen, only in the baseball sense, I would add. We have Stephen Young, Global Executive Director of the Core Roundtable, a principled approach to global capitalism. So Steve will tie all this together and give the ethical grounding to all of this discussion. Thanks, Steve.
Right. My challenge in this Council for Ethics and International Affairs is to be ethical, right? Which briefly reminds me of a story. It was Hal Berman, one of my professors at the Harvard Law School, who really did some marvelous work on the intersection of law and religion. She's got two books. I commend it to everybody on how basically so much of our modern law, secular law, was derived first from the Gregorian reforms about 1100, secondly from the Protestant and Lutheran reforms in the 1500s. Anyway, the story was that some first-year law school student at Harvard at one point didn't like the outcome of a particular torts case, puts up his hand, the professor, a Kingsfield type, says, yes. And he says, but, sir, it's not just. And the professor says, ha, young man. If it's justice you want, go to the divinity school. So I'm going to try to do something here, and I apologize. I'm going to just give you the tip of the tip of some icebergs, and hopefully I will be succinct but not simplistic. Let me start with a reminder of Marx's thesis on Fairback. I think it was thesis number 29, where Marx said, up to now, philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. Now, I think my colleagues have given us a theme, which you were all sort of sitting there, and my sense is you were sort of becoming disheartened and disenchanted as the conversation went on, that we live in a period of deep fragmentation. Other things were said, but let me pick that up as a theme to which I can try to respond. We have a crisis of power and a crisis of norms and a crisis of institutionalization, as Parag said. Let me suggest very briefly that institutions arrive when power is subordinated to norms. Problem is, we have no norms. Problem is, we have no leadership. And one of the sort of truisms in the study of leadership and in the study of ethics is that leadership and values are umbilically united. They're Siamese twins. I heard the other day that something like $8 billion is spent every year in the United States on leadership training and coaching and mentoring. I suggested at a meeting in St. Paul the other week of a bunch of coaches and mentors that the reason why they're doing so well is that we have no leaders. The interesting thing to me was nobody argued with me. We focus on leadership. We don't focus on values. And let me say, that is where we should turn our attention. And I will get to my little chart on the table in a second. Let me sort of pass over some aspects of my background, but fundamentally, lots of time in Asia. I spent the summer living with the Zinakantakans in Chiapas, speaking Tzotzil, which I can no longer speak. I spent another summer living in Banchiang in northeast Thailand. I speak Thai, still speak a little bit. I've done a lot of work in Southeast Asia. I was a very young member of the Council on Foreign Relations. I actually came up with the solution, Parag, of the UN administration to solve the war in Cambodia, manipulating various concepts of the Mandala, Theravada, Buddhist, China, Vietnam, stuff like that. So my thinking has evolved out of some of those kinds of... Oh, by the way, I worked very closely with Bill Colby on counterinsurgency, village development, pacification in South Vietnam, which was a very successful program, by the way. But what I would say underlies... in a deep conceptual way, the fragmentation of the world. Let me submit that the epistemology of modern civilization is a fundamental nihilism. And when you're fundamentally nihilistic, there are no norms. There are no values. The only thing you have is power. And power is something that fragments, unless you have somebody who's more powerful than the others. So therefore, I suggest that a large part of our implicit cognitive thinking is Hobbesian. In the tradition of China, it would be Mozza. It is the kind of social Darwinism that we saw with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Kill or be killed, eat or be eaten. It's a Spencerian vision. And so, therefore, we worry a great deal about the loss of American hegemony. Query, did we ever really have hegemony? Did Roosevelt have hegemony over Winston Churchill? Or, dare I say, Charles de Gaulle in World War II? And so the rise of the rest or the decline of the West becomes very relevant in a world where there are no values, there's only power. Let me suggest, however, a second point, that I will challenge the thesis that we're going to some stage of human history without the West, because I would argue that the rise of the rest is because they westernized. If we were having this conversation in this room, or better yet, at the council, in the 1950s or 1960s, our discussions would probably be about industrialization, modernization, and the term that used to be used, but which is now no longer politically correct, was westernization, creating many problematics for, say, Japanese, Chinese, Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes back to one of the key theses of Max Weber, several of his key theses, is can you industrialize, can you modernize without westernizing? Westernization being interpreted as a certain kind of secular rationality within a range of expressions from, let's say, the English Revolution of 1688 to the American Revolution to the French Revolution. So you've got the more sort of extreme rationalistic side is the French Revolution, Rousseau, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My argument is that we would not have China in position today, et cetera, without some form of westernization. How many of you, by the way, have been to the new airport in Beijing? That is not an expression of Ming Qing culture. Right? You couldn't have built that thing without a lot of very Western engineering and mathematics and physics and stuff like that, which were not homegrown in China. What we are talking about underlying all these discussions here is the convergence of all these societies at various levels to what? OECD standards of life and physical infrastructure, economic systems, political systems, et cetera, et cetera. However, with caveats, because not everybody is necessarily happy with the value fallout of this Weberian thesis. What are the two great worries that we sort of have, which are very difficult to talk about? One great worry is, will the Muslim community, will the Ummah of Muslims ever finally make it into our world of secular rationality? And that's a big thing they debate all the time, and they're talking about secular rationality is not necessarily a good thing. Second thing we worry about is, what about all the people in sub-Saharan Africa? Are they going to make it into our world in some sense? So let me say that what we're really doing is discussing a new phase, a new era in the rise of the West, which has created more power around the world, but something has happened. We've lost our notion of core values, we've lost our norms, and therefore we're left with power, and therefore we're left with not only a range of unethical behaviors, but we're left with the challenges that my colleagues have spoken about. Is there an alternative? Let me be very provocative here, and suggest, yes, there is. And this is the next phase, let me say, in the rise of the West, which includes the rest. And this gets to that little chart that we worked on the co-roundtable. Very briefly, on that chart, you will see the seven normative principles of the co-roundtable, ethical principles for business, the six key stakeholder groups coming out of business ethics or corporate social responsibility, aligned with 11 different religions in a matrix chart, and every box is filled in. We've also since then done a 12th one of these things, which is Serbian Orthodox Church, because when we were in Serbia, our Serbian colleague said, Steve, you know, Serbs, they don't like the Europeans, they don't like the Americans, we're Serbs, we're the best people in the world, and if anything's going to happen in Serbia, it's got to have Serbian values behind it. So I said, so what are Serbian values? So I'm introduced to a bishop who gives me a book, gives me a long, long thing to read about St. Sava, who was the son of a great Serbian king who left that to found the Serbian Orthodox Church in about 1100. He gets a special dispensation from some patriarch somewhere to call the church the Serbian Orthodox Church, because this is a way for the Serbian people, as a privileged chosen people, to have their own relationship with God, and may I be unfair to any Serbs in the audience, have something really special above all these other people. And of course, the Serbian sense of who they are really locked in when the Turks arrived. So the point is that with all these different religions, by the way, the idea for doing this came from a colleague, Tom Dunphy, who was at the Wharton School. Tom passed away about 2 years ago, and he was pushing me for years to do this, and I said, Tom, I can't do it. But part of me was still that old anthropologist, and he put me to work, and lo and behold, this thing emerged. What's the implication? Implication is their core human values, which are the same everywhere. That's a radical proposition. Let me try to give you several instances. One, when I go to China, and I've done this several times, I present the co-roundtable ethical principles and good governance and transparency and accountability not as American creations, not as coming from the UN, not as invented by SAI, by Alice Tepper Marlin here in New York, SAI 8000, stuff like that. None of this anti-Chinese stuff. You know, lo and behold, all these things I'm talking about, actually they come from Confucius and Mencius. And I quote, you know, boom, 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 boom. Okay, so we have an Islamic setting in various places. So what do we do? So I give the whole spiel, and I say, you know, here are the parts of the Quran that say this is really good Quranic guidance here. Oh, really, really? Yeah, I just happen to be an American. Thailand, I just had a project. I was just teaching in Sasin in Bangkok, and I had my MBA students do an analysis, an assessment of four big Thai banks for CSR variables in line with principles of Theravada Buddhism, which His Majesty is talking about. So students go out and they do this analysis, they come back and they get number results using Theravada, but they're measuring the same things that you and I talk about here. We can talk in very enlightenment, you know, rationality kinds of terms, or the best standards from the National Association of Corporate Directors, or you name it. If it is true that there are some core values, then that gives hope and optimism to what I think Parag was on the edge of recommending, not merely describing. I think I was hearing you, Parag, saying this is a good thing, this fragmentation, this decentralization, because it's created this globality. What we're lacking in globality is a sense of a core set of norms so we can actually get some leadership, so we can do something about climate change, about energy, about governance, about the fiscal thing. Okay, climate change and energy. Let me suggest a better alternative to Copenhagen is a movement. How many of you were in the movement of the early 1960s? Anybody remember that? The movement. Okay, that was the civil rights movement. That was a movement. And we had songs, and we had all kinds of things. And people got out there and they did stuff, right? We marched from Selma to Montgomery and stuff like that, okay? We have a movement. It's the stuff that's going on. People can act either on an individual capacity, a neighborhood capacity, a city capacity, a corporate capacity, et cetera, to do something about this intersection of climate change and energy. We can conserve more, and a lot of people in the environmental movement, right, have been promoting this for 40 years now. So you can do that. Global economic governance. Well, what went wrong? There are several different issues, but let's focus on them. About to run out of time. Let's focus on the key thing that went wrong, which was the financial crisis, and may I say it here in Manhattan, the death of Wall Street. The enormity of what happened in October 2008, I don't think has sunk in, particularly among us Americans. What happened was that the institutions which made America, which made global America, which made our hegemony possible, died. There is no longer any investment bank that started after the Civil War that made American capitalism so good. They are all gone. Some of them really gone, right? Like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. The others are finagling new kinds of legal relationships. Why? Because they need access to the Fed. Why? Because they're turning over huge profits. What is Goldman Sachs these days? Goldman Sachs is not an investment banking house that built up our great corporations. Goldman Sachs is a trading machine. Just read the FT and see how many profits it makes every day, executing hundreds of millions of trades at nanosecond speed to make a 0.000 cent per trade, right? Now, you do 0.00 cent per trade over 100 million, you make a lot of money, ladies and gentlemen, and you can pay out a lot of bonuses, $16 billion. That's not J.P. Morgan. No, that's not Andrew Carnegie putting together U.S. Steel, right? That's not the old Harriman doing railroads and stuff. That Wall Street, which built us up, is gone, it's dead, and it's never coming back for a number of reasons. What killed it off? The quick answer is greed. The deeper answer is imprudence, mispricing of assets, excessive risk-taking, miserable risk management. Therefore, what's the solution? Oh, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, and I haven't seen very many people talk about this at all, from our distinguished advisor in the White House to our knowledgeable Secretary of the Treasury and people in the prior regime. The same thing has been happening since 1636 on a regular basis, exactly the same thing. There is no fundamental difference between what these guys in New York, our best and our brightest, right, the graduates of my schools, Harvard, Chicago, Wharton, all these places, right, being paid millions and millions and millions of dollars. They were doing the same thing that those dealers in tulip bulbs were doing in Holland in 1636. They got the prices wrong. They fed into an asset bubble. They borrowed all this stuff, and it all collapsed. And a whole lot of ordinary poor people were hurt. And the wealthy people who've taken the cash out early, not so bad. 400 years and we haven't learned how to deal with this thing? Not very reassuring. So the issue comes, how do you get a handle on prudence and risk management in financial markets? So one, you promote CSR, which is values-based. Two, you use this sort of core values to come up with either a global standard or country-by-country sets of corporate governance, standards for corporate governance and methods of measurement coming out of the quality movement. It's not rocket science. And thirdly, we've got to do something about the pricing mechanism. Here we probably need some sort of state intervention where the issue is that the solution to the problem is very simple. Those who create risk have to shoulder the cost of risk. So as you're issuing more and more financial instruments for other people to buy, you've got to put more and more money into the pot. Your first tranche of SMOs or CDOs or something like that, you can issue it's all profit. Your 15th tranche, you've got to buy an insurance policy, which is going to eliminate all your profits. Once your profits are eliminated, what are you going to do? You're not going to do it. So we can tamp in volatility in private markets using private governance mechanisms. So, but all of this, I suggest to you, depends on having some set of core values. And may I also suggest that those core values are out there in humanity. Thank you very much.
You are listening to an audio program sponsored by the Carnegie Council. Please take a moment to support these voices for ethics. Visit us online at www.carnegiecouncil.org and click on the button marked support. We return you now to the panel who will take questions from the audience. Enjoy the rest of the program.
One of the themes based on Harry Harding's eloquent presentation, a year and a half ago, on this theme, Rise of the Rest, Harry Harding, our friend, put it as the world is now two political parties, one that likes status quo in the international system and democracy at home, and the other party that likes just the opposite. Democracy in the world and status quo at home. So I asked him, so are these two parties going to cooperate or what? And he said, what you mean is bipartisanship possible? So I'd like to put it, just to continue on that theme, based on actually the diverse opinions on this panel, do you see cooperation as power, I would say, converges in the international system or harmonizes or however you want to put it, is cooperation possible? Thanks.
I think, Devin, the response has to be case-specific. I mean, I don't think we can talk about general norms or general patterns a la Hans Morgenthau or something like that. When I'm listening to you, my response is cooperation responsible? Let's take within a range of political communities in the Islamic world. I'd say yes, but things have to happen in terms of ideas and engagement and things like that. Is cooperation possible with China? Yes, but I think we have to engage, we non-Chinese, have to engage the Chinese people over the heads of their government around the issue of what is Chinese identity? What do they want in the world? Where are they going in the world? And I think that conversation, that can happen, but it needs to be engaged in by us who are non-Chinese, with a sense of understanding and respect and depth for a variety of Chinese traditions and a range of answers among the Chinese as to what is China and where are they going. And I could go on from there. I think fundamentally, if I am right, if there is a core of decency to human beings, if there is a core set of values, then obviously cooperation has to be in the cards.
Nick?
Thanks. This touches on one of the four dialogues, and that gives us a good answer to the question, which is the dialogue between the United States and China, particularly over the last year. And the record there is mixed. It shows, I think, that China and the U.S. have shown an appreciation that there are problems that both of them need to be involved in order to solve, but that there is still deep-seated reluctance in both Washington and Beijing for what, to use Harry's term, bipartisanship would entail. From the Chinese side, this would mean that China would have to assume more of the risks. If we take this theory about if you create risk, you assume more of the burden of the risk. The United States has an interesting problem with this, which is, first of all, the extent to which we have conceived of dialogues as we have a vision, we go to another country, we modify our vision slightly for that other country to buy in, but that it's not really a give and take. And the real reluctance that we have in this concept of the G2, which would be that America's global priorities are not China's global priorities, are not Brazil's global priorities, are not India's global priorities necessarily. And if you want another country to take your top five priority list issues, what are you prepared to put or concede? And there's been a real reluctance to do that at this point. The other question, this is from the security side, is that bipartisanship is possible, but then what sort of world of the future do you want? And this is something that comes up when we talk about greater burden sharing for global security. On the one hand, we want more countries to do more in the world, and we take the piracy issue. So we want more countries to deploy navies, to take over responsibility for patrolling. On the other hand, we look askance at the idea of China and India developing aircraft carriers, building blue water navies, because the same capabilities that can be used to cooperate with us could also be used to hinder us. And so we have a real issue at this point, which is we want more global cooperation, we want more burden sharing, but we're reluctant to lose some of the advantages that we have accrued in the security sense, because if an India or a China or a Brazil, which, you know, Brazil is going to launch its own nuclear submarines, India will launch its own nuclear submarines, if these capabilities are diffused and spread throughout the world, then what happens if those countries don't always choose to see eye to eye on the relationship? I think Secretary Clinton's visit to Brazil, which got some coverage in the American press, but perhaps not as much as it should have, is really shows some of the limits that we have in how we're reaching out in terms of the dialogue with some of these other rising partners. And it fundamentally comes down to, well, what is it that we want? And if we don't know what we want, it's harder to say what we're prepared to compromise on in order to get that cooperation. So bipartisanship in theory is possible, but both the last and the current administrations haven't really laid out a compelling vision which has been able to produce a reciprocal effect in some of these other states.
It's a generic question, so Craig.
I'm cautiously optimistic, though, for slightly different reasons from Nick and for Stephen. I think that the key factor is having the emergence of a dialogue, not so much about identities, because I don't think it's our business really to tell the Chinese what their identity is, but rather about shared interests. It has been said, with great power comes great responsibility, to quote that famous philosopher, the Amazing Spider-Man. But one of the consequences of the desire for recognition as an emerging power, as a great power, is precisely the need to accept responsibility as a stakeholder for the international order. We see this increasingly among the millennials, among the emerging global citizens that I spoke about, and we see this in terms of the sort of environmental sensibility, as well as sensibilities on issues like global poverty, armament, and the like as well. And we also see this beginning to influence national leaders. I think, you know, the great significance of Copenhagen, as we'll see when we look back on it in 20 or 30 years' time, is ultimately not that it didn't produce a treaty, but rather that the U.S. president, ultimately the leader of the indispensable nation, was able to bang heads together and produce a rough consensus, which included both the largest developing powers agreeing that they had a responsibility to reduce emissions, and the richest developed countries agreeing that they had the responsibility to fork over not billions, not tens of billions, but hundreds of billions of dollars over time in order to make this feasible. I think we're going to see, indeed we already have seen, the emergence of a discussion of things like the Tobin tax. One of the Security Council powers, France admittedly, but nonetheless on the Security Council, has already endorsed this idea. And I think that the notion of global bargains, of global institutions, in a sort of rough, coordinating way that Parag described, rather than in a supranational parliamentary way, is possible. On the other hand, there's also danger, and that remains the same exacerbated nationalisms that turned the 20th century into a century of bloodshed. you know, the notion of the two world wars as a response to a sort of rear-end collision between emergent Germany and the existing powers doesn't, I think, require rehearsal for a group like this. The question as to whether or not that will be the history of the 21st century or whether the same kinds of ties at a person-to-person, group-to-group, and country-to-country level, which are incomparably stronger than they were in 1914, which of these will prevail is going to be the history of the century, shape the history of the century.
I'll just make a quick comment on Devin's point about this tension between status quo and democracy. I think the net on that is going to be a world which you might describe as to each his own. You see more and more of what Charles Kupchan of Georgetown calls the autonomy rule, engaging with other countries in such a way that one can't push too far beyond the extent to which one is really respecting their own autonomy and self-directed evolution. And I think we'll see more of that. And I think that's a good thing because it allows nations to become more confident, not feel at threat or at risk of American intervention or manipulation, and develop their own confident set of values and priorities and interests. And I don't believe that countries will engage, whether on the values level, as Stephen is recommending, or on the interest level, as Craig is recommending, unless they first have that confidence in their own autonomy. But then, at that point, you can start to experiment with these kinds of G20 plus or minus kinds of mechanisms and get coalitions of the willing, in the good sense of the term, not necessarily the Rumsfeldian sense of the term, around the table as and when necessary. So I am hopeful cautiously, but not because we are forcing international cooperation, but we're allowing it to more organically sort of germinate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had understood that this meeting was on climate change. Am I mistaken in that understanding?
I was
author 40 years ago as a member of Congress of the Environmental Education Act, the purpose of which you will tell from its name was to give federal support to schools and colleges and universities to teach about the environment. I do not know to what extent environmental education is provided in the United States today because I've been occupied with other matters. But as I was given to understand the subject of this meeting, climate change, has any of you any comments to make about the state in the United States or elsewhere in the world of education about the environment? I yield back the balance of my time.
In true parliamentarian diplomacy, Steve.
Mr. Congressman, just two quick sort of personal anecdotes. One is my observation raising children and seeing grandchildren being raised since 1972, that there was far more systematic discussion of the environment, of sustainability, of projects, little third graders doing things about whether it's turtles or trees, I know, than I ever had. So I would say that something changed. Secondly, and in support, I think, maybe of a blend, Craig, of both interest and values, in the last 2 years, I've just felt everywhere around the world, something has happened, there's been a shift around the words sustainability and green. And I'm not aware of any particular trigger. I mean, it was, with all due respects to former Vice President Gore, I don't think it was his movie, but maybe it was people had, you know, hotter summers, hotter winter, something, but about 2 years ago. And the acid test, it seems to me, is in corporations around the world, where sustainability and green was received with the same enthusiasm as ethics and CSR and, you know, other stuff.
Green
as in the right kind of green, right, not the Gordon Gekko green. It's now like you can get everybody standing up and waving flags among business people if you talk about sustainability and what we are doing and reducing our carbon footprint. As I said, I can't tell you why, but the consciousness about these issues is a lot higher all around the world than it's ever been.
Anyone else?
Yeah, Craig? I mean, John, I think you succeeded beyond your wildest dreams in that sense. I remember the first Earth Day in 1970, going with high school friends to meetings, then seeing Earth Day in 1990 when Broadway was packed with people who were attending. And part of that reflects the sort of environmental education program Stephen was talking about. I think another important factor is the communications revolution that I was speaking about as well, particularly for adults, for people who are out of school. Media discussions of issues like global warming have been one of the key consciousness-raising factors. And the fact that so many people are plugged into media across national lines, the fact that media read each other across national lines, I think has also been a key factor in developing this awareness.
Parag, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions relating to your thesis regarding the crisis of global governance and how that relates back to the climate change debate. I had the misfortune to participate as a negotiator in Copenhagen and in the lead-up meetings. And I would argue that rather than a crisis of governance, really what we had was a crisis of confidence or a lack of trust between the big players around the table, a lack of trust in the developed world that it would make good on its historical responsibility for the problem, a huge part of that being the failure in Washington to enact climate legislation that would allow the US to come on board with a binding target, and also a crisis of confidence the other way in that the big developing countries would take up their responsibility and put forward some mitigation actions that would help get the world on a sustainable pathway. It's clear to all that Copenhagen ended up being a economic debate, an economic negotiation about share of development and atmospheric space. We didn't really see the regional groupings that you were talking about, but rather groupings based on confluence of interests. For instance, the major developing emitters, the basic countries, the Coalition for Rainforest Nations. The specific questions that I had is, will the regional approaches or the informal networks that you talk about deliver a renewal of global and mutual confidence that we need to address climate change? Will we not end up with a cycle of regional emissions reduction goals and border tax adjustments that will lead to a very inefficient way to tackle climate change? And if it's not the UN, then what other forum could you envisage that would allow a voice for those countries that are most impacted by climate change, such as the island states that I was negotiating with, to have their concerns addressed?
I'm sure others will probably want to speak on climate change as well, but I'm glad the question was raised because I was going to offer a slightly different interpretation from what Craig had said earlier. First, on the crisis of confidence of trust, I most certainly agree with that. I think there are two things going on in these dynamics, in the dynamics of summit diplomacy that we need to be aware of, and both are very cynical points. The first is that each country can see what is happening at home in the other countries. The Chinese diplomats don't need to go to Copenhagen to know, just from what their embassy tells them in Washington, that the U.S. is not really serious about this, and that legislation is not going to be nearly as robust as what the global this global confidence standard would require. The second is the role of the need to save face and the media and so forth. You know, the insider accounts of what happened there, not only amongst the lobbying pressures and momentum and the movement of smaller, sort of more victimized states, but the account of what was really happening in that small private session where Obama, as Craig said, sort of, you know, knocked heads together, is really quite different from that, right? It was about how can China and India and others get away with the absolute bare minimum, and when this summit fails, how can the failure be hung around Obama's neck and others and not theirs? And so those two dynamics, again, as I gave you the caveat, very cynical, but that's exactly what is going on in the nation's capitals around the world, without a doubt, and you've seen it firsthand because you were there. So how do you get from there to a more positive dynamic? First of all, the lofty goal of recreating, again, to the extent there ever was one, an atmosphere of global confidence and trust is something that you don't aspire towards. It can happen if certain other things are done. So I think we should be focusing on those other things. Those other things, some of which include regional trends. So if you look within the European Union, they have seen that cap and trade hasn't been as successful as they thought. They've seen emissions going up as the economic crisis has hit hard. But they've responded by saying, well, we're going to redouble investment into clean energy or invest massively more in it. We're going to strengthen carbon tax regimes and so forth. So you have within at least one regional theater efforts to maintain and to set global standards irrespective of what's happening at the international level. Then you're going to have your ad hoc mechanisms. What Sarkozy is likely to do, in fact, next year, as France chairs the G8 and the G20, is to push a clean energy free trade area, which is a form of soft protectionism, basically saying countries that subsidize fossil fuel will simply not be allowed to trade in this market. And this is this is somewhat cynical, but it represents the factual development of more and more cross-border sorts of schemes that are going to try in one way or the other to reduce emissions, but in a way that at least is still aligned with national self-interest. Yes, there were, of course, many coalitions that fall out of the regional sphere, and that's why at least one can still argue that climate is this one truly global issue. For example, Nick used the term global security earlier. I simply deny the existence of any such thing other than in the nuclear sphere. There's no such thing. If we really thought there was global security, then we really would invest so much more effort into reconstituting this Global Security Council. The truth is that China and others want to be the policemen of their own neighborhood, and they're perfectly comfortable with being regional hegemons, and global security be damned, whatever architecture it has or doesn't have. You can't say that about the climate. So there's still some hope that if we experiment in lots of different ways, and I didn't speak enough about the public-private partnerships that are underway, but that's an arena where American clean tech companies, European wind and solar and other companies are actively moving out into the emerging markets and helping them to reduce their carbon footprint in an affordable way, such that one day, if they can confidently show up at negotiations and say, we have the technology and access to technology to reduce our emissions, and therefore we can negotiate in much better faith and trust.
As the grandfather of a recent Berkeley graduate in green engineering, problem is that the engineering is being focused on in the job world. The green part is a secondary factor. As right straight across the board, how do you move the competency of engineering and meld it with the green so you get things done? And I'll use Stephen Young because by and large, the green part is not being valued in the job market.
May I expand the challenge to all professional schools, dropping in just briefly law schools and business schools, right? What I would argue that in law schools these days, the notion of being an officer of the court is sort of long since gone. We've been a business for 30 years now. Show me the money, right? MBA, financial crisis, ethics, et cetera, need I say more? I think here we have very serious problems with disciplines and with incentive systems. And the challenges are, to what do we look? Do we look, a la Adam Smith, to self-interest and market incentives and an invisible hand? Or do we look to some sort of more ideologically, intellectually, rationally based vision, ideal, that we're then going to sort of try to implement? And I go agnostic. I can give you a case in our own work with Co and things like that, that sometimes this seems to work better, sometimes that works better. Building back on what Craig was saying, you know, is it values or is it interest? I think the two have to come together and reinforce each other. If you're going to go out and save the world and you studied about being green or you've taken all the business ethics courses and you can't get a job, this is a disincentive on a number of levels. So I think one of the great changes for markets and for capitalism is where are the points of leverage and change so that in incentives begin to change. Now, where my thinking is going, and it's sort of daunting and depressing, is because it leads to a huge scale problem, you got to go to the ultimate customers because they drive the system. If the buyers out there want green, the sellers will then produce green. In order to produce green, they're going to have to hire engineers and architects like my. This is a living issue for my son, too, who's an architect in San Francisco. You know, then they'll produce green. If the sellers don't give a rip, I'm sorry, if the buyers, the ultimate buyers don't give a rip, whether it's green or not green, it's not going to flow back. And ultimately, if the business needs to deliver it, they'll go back to the schools. This is a former dean of a law school, I can tell you, we are very worried about where our graduates go. Because if we can't place our graduates in high-paying jobs, we don't get them in the front end. So how then do you sort of get the word out there? This is a more of a background to my notion. If you get a movement going, if people actually pay, if somebody will not buy a house because it doesn't have LEED certification, or if, and you're starting to see, everybody know what LEED certification is? It's like sort of state of the art, which is probably not that great, but it's better than others in terms of energy efficiency and things like that. If you're starting to see companies pay, it costs more money too, to pay more money. Also, NGOs are sort of doing this, pay more money to get a LEED certified building, and then they tout this. And the argument is McAllister College in St. Paul just did a big fancy new building for global citizenship. It's big league. It's all over the place. It's LEED. They're pretty much convinced that's going to get them more students of the kind of students they want. If companies will do LEED certification, and then that'll give them better customers or something like that, or easier to hire the kind of knowledge workers that they want. I think that's the way to go. It combines values and interests, but how do you get out to all those potential purchasers?
In 1963, President John F. Kennedy said that we cannot, that the United States has only 5% of the world's population, and we cannot automatically expect an American solution for the world. And I'm wondering if in 2010, with the U.S. with 5% of the world's population, would the world be better off if the United States had a lower profile? Why, when President Obama says we are broke, are we spending a lot of money in Iraq, in Afghanistan, concerned about Pakistan, concerned about Iran? Vice President Biden is in the Middle East. Wouldn't the world perhaps be better off if the other 95% of the world took responsibility for the future rather than this over-reliance on the United States?
Well, those are small questions. Farag, why don't you start?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's important, and I think this was one of the great strengths of Stephen's comments at the beginning of this discussion, was to point out that it should be less about where the ideas came from than what the idea is. And I think you did a very good job of pointing out that, hey, you're just an American there, but this is, you know, these business ethical, these principles are embedded deeply in Confucianism. So what are you trying to push here, an American solution to climate change or the technical, scientific, mechanical engineering solutions that are necessary? I think the latter is more important than the former. However those get spread, the better. But I think Stephen is right that a light footprint approach, I think this might be what you're implying as well, is better than one that has a certain national taint to it. Functional problems don't need national solutions as such. So I think that you both have the right gist there. When it comes to, and I would distinguish those from some of the political questions that you are talking about. There are places in the world where if the United States were not playing a certain role behind the scenes or overtly as a geopolitical balancer, things would look even worse than they do right now. And there are parts of the Middle East that are like that, parts of the Far East that are like that. Even as someone who's written a book, attacking some of the perverse effects of American military power around the world, I would have to say that we shouldn't overlook that. It would be factually incorrect. So that doesn't mean that you're not right. I would still agree that we could be more judicious in where we are. But it's only to say that the fact that American leaders somehow always feel compelled to be out there in the world providing American resources or asserting themselves is not solely because that's an American way of being. There is a certain supply and demand, and there is still a certain demand for American leadership in many parts of the world.
As I recall, 2 years ago, Flint Leverett made the point of distinguishing between the relative decline in other spheres and America's continuing military preeminence was one way of putting it, but there is this dichotomy that's clearly part of this discussion.
I would add something to that.
Oh, sure.
I think there are two things to keep in mind. One is that we may be broke, but there is what Colin Powell called the pottery barn theory of international relations. When it comes to Iraq, Afghanistan, and even Pakistan, it can be said that we broke it.
and we own it, and we have to fix it. I think Parag is right that we'll be more judicious in our use of military power in the future. But I think, and I also think he's correct in saying that there'll be more regional and local solutions in the future. Nonetheless, I think there remains a profound truth in what James Chase said in his notion of America as the indispensable nation for solving many problems. And that reflects the combination of power, because while we may not be hegemonic, we will still be the leading force for a good year to come, or for a good many decades to come. We are the only major power, for instance, that is going to gain population over the next few decades till we reach the level of 400 to 500 million by mid-century. We are also the only one which has a self-concept, a set of values, and a set of institutions which have enjoyed the kind of global popularity and continue to enjoy global prestige. And I think we remain the only actor that will have the kind of convening power and occasionally coercive power that is necessary to lead when it comes to many of the key issues that face the international community. I think what happened in the room in Copenhagen is an interesting example. It may well have been that the Chinese and the Indians were trying to avoid losing face. The fact is, though, that it was an American president who was able to get them into the room and get something out of them. I think that's likely to be the case for a long time to come.
I'll give a very, very quick comment, if I may, because I think there's a values perspective to what you say, too. There's a what bothers me is a shrinking of our intellectual capacities about how you do things. One, the concepts of partnership, being a fiduciary, being a steward, are no longer so current. They're no longer taught in law school. They never come up in business school. And the whole concept of being a partner, of being a fiduciary, of being a steward, is working with others who are different from you, but whom you respect, and you need to work together. And I sense less and less in our rhetoric across the board, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or something, a notion that an American way in the world is a way of being a steward, a fiduciary, a partner, a good friend, the office of a friend, an old 18th century expression we've lost. We think in terms of zero sum and power, and we are ethically shrunk, and I think you're onto something there.
Okay. Nick, did you want to? Just briefly, I mean, it's interesting, as Devin reminded me, that question came up at the first of these panels back in 2007, and the issue about whether or not a pullback, having the U.S. be a bit less involved, would also be a way to focus on issues at home and to spread some of the burden sharing around. I think that this touches on another question, too, which is, if you look at the last successful major international coalition that the U.S. put together to tackle an issue, if we can conceive of the first Gulf War as that coalition-building exercise, it doesn't mean that America provides a solution, but it was a situation where America was willing to, in order to get a certain outcome, was willing to walk away or backtrack on some of the things it might have preferred to have happened but didn't see as essential to happening. That's how you could put together a coalition. And you saw the result, which is George Bush and James Baker and were attacked for that. You should have done this. You should have stood up for going all the way to Baghdad and doing this and that, even though the coalition that they put together paid for the war, was not a burden on the United States. It was, as Flint and actually Flint Leverett referenced it, it was the last time that the U.S. actually made a profit, if we can be so crass to mention that. It paved the way for the Madrid Peace Conference to begin starting, hopefully moving the Middle East forward, and whether, you know, they could say, well, maybe that was a, you know, stillborn process. But it was one where the U.S. went in and there was a give-and-take relationship. There was a deal-making approach, and it was about making sure that others were invested in the solution. And you contrast that with the coalition in 2003 going into Iraq. You contrast that with current efforts to try to put together a sanctions regime on Iran, and you just don't see that same kind of international buy-in. It's either other countries refusing to help, giving minimal compliance, or otherwise just simply, you know, not being that cooperative. And I think that it's, as Kennedy had it right, it's not going to be an American solution, but American leadership may be critical to getting a solution through, but you also have to have leadership in the United States that is willing to make compromises and is willing to defend those compromises and is not going to fold at the first sign of congressional protest or bad reaction in the media. that can make an argument for why you do that. And going back to the climate change thing, it's and interconnectedness. People now know that what happens in Washington is not a secret. And people knew that the president going in had no clout on the climate issue because he couldn't get something through Congress, and you could see how Congress was going to stymie it, and that undermines the leadership that the U.S. can provide. And, you know, willingness to say, well, these are things that have to happen and these are compromises that have to occur, you know, that's really going to be sort of a challenge that we're going to face in the future.
Well put. We have time for one last question.
My question relates to existing global institutions and the diffusion or decentralization of diplomacy that's been discussed. In a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with the lead negotiator for the G77 in China in Copenhagen, he basically said the outcome was exclusively defined by the division within the G2. So my question is really, is the global legitimacy of global governing arrangements significant, an important issue for those doing the deciding? This is an issue that's arisen in the UN. It's arisen with non-BRIC members, I think new members of the G20. It arises with Greece and its debt crisis. And it has to do with how to ensure legitimacy. Is there the possibility for creating a constituency system? And if so, how would it work? What is the role of the UN? What is the role of the IMF in propositions such as Mervyn King, the head of the central bank in the UK, to merge the G20 with the IMF? So I'd like your reflections on any of these questions.
I'm tempted to say, being cheeky and responding to that, is given what Parag was saying, where I'm coming from, is who cares? let's have 100. Let's have, what are we at, 6 billion? Let's have 6 billion flowers bloom. Somehow, some process of decentralization, of engagement, of leadership across the board, based obviously on some sense of core values, which most of us would accept as constructive and leading to well-being of the planet and people. Let's do that. And let's not play inside baseball with G2, G20, G8, this group, that group, because that, under current circumstances of power dynamics and interest, ain't getting us anywhere.
I'll just say that, you know, when you spoke of global legitimacy and then immediately switched to a discussion you had with someone from the G77, we should never conflate the notion that something is legitimate with whether or not the G77 or some other group has signed off on it or not. Clearly, the G20 came into existence, and there are many G77 members that are very concerned about the fact that they're not vested in or included in those discussions. And yet it goes forward, and the G20 is as close as anything we have today to a universally, you know, legitimate, it's not universal, but a universally recognized forum that people perceive as being legitimate. And so I think that, you know, we have to really pull these terms apart. The G77 also is this incredibly antiquated legacy sort of group, and India is, you know, which is a traditional leader of the G77, is much more interested in climbing into the higher echelons and more closed-door, narrow tables than in leading this so-called G77. So I would say that the legitimacy of the G77 is more in doubt than anything else. I think that clearly what the G20 proves is that you can move ahead through ad hoc mechanisms and focus on efficiency and delivery, and that has a legitimacy and a currency unto itself, that that the notion of just going through existing institutions does not have. I think one of the supreme ironies of global governance today is that you enhance your legitimacy by circumventing the existing architecture, because the existing architecture is so incredibly slow and inefficient. And the impatience that animates so much action today really speaks to that. People say, if you want to get something done, go around the UN, go around the Security Council. But then you'll be legitimate because you got something done. And that's not just, one of the first examples of that was the Kosovo War, and that was in the security sphere. And now we apply that same principle to everything, whether it's climate or poverty. Go out and do something, as Steve would say, earns you legitimacy much more than being diplomatic for the sake of it.
Great. The point I'd make briefly is that the growth of connectedness and a sense of collective responsibility also establishes new possibilities for legitimate action. Globalization has helped create these, and I'll cite the example of clients of ours, the World Wildlife Fund. We work with them to help publicize stakeholder dialogues about aquaculture. These involve negotiating a set of standards between producing nations in the northern Europe, South America, and Southeast Asia, and companies that purchase seafood and their own buyers and the NGOs concerned with them in northern Europe and the U.S. So that the salmon, when it is sold in a store here, will have a stamp indicating that it was raised in conformity with certain environmental standards. It's the sort, well, it's not even a public-private partnership, it's a private-private partnership, and one that is essentially market-driven by the increasing environmental consciousness of consumers in the developed world. This sort of thing is unimaginable before an era with the degrees of connectedness and of collective consciousness that we're speaking about. I doubt it's going to solve the problem of nuclear weapons will be solved in this way. But there are a myriad of issues which may well develop solutions that don't even pass through governmental channels. The key factor that makes them legitimate is simply that the key stakeholders find ways to talk to each other and find ways to achieve a solution they think is legitimate. So in that sense, if you think this business of global government is all a bit fishy, I'd say that might be an optimistic thought.
Last word, Nick.
Sure. Just to close on this idea of the personal ties and stakeholders talking to each other, what will be, I think, important to monitor and keep an eye on in the coming years is which stakeholders are talking to whom, in what fora, and what kind of relationships they have. Right after we had the last of these sessions, there was one of these BRIC summits, and it's a photograph that I've seen reproduced a lot and in a lot of Brazilian, Indian, Chinese, and Russian media. It was Hu Jintao, Dmitry Medvedev, President Lula, and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, and sort of coming together. And the fact that it sent an image of, well, this is the globe, and it had that kind of, I don't want to say rainbow coalition look to it, but it did have a kind of look that said this represents the world, or this is more universal in a way than when you look at photos of the G7 summits or things like that. And then the question will be, which presidents and prime ministers are meeting with each other? Which companies, which partnerships are developing? Are they more likely to be between us in the United States and in the rising world? Are they between each other, which was Weber's original thesis? And the fact that, you know, where about bureaucracies and stakeholders within each country? Where do they see the future value? I find it interesting to monitor, you know, say the Russo-Indian relationship, which is not simply that Prime Ministers Putin and Singh have a good relationship, but their bureaucracies get along with each other. In contrast to with Putin and Bush when both were president, that they could have great summit meetings, but then their bureaucracies stymied everything that they tried to do. So the question is, where are those interconnectedness, where are those things developing? David had raised the Shanghai grouping, and people say, well, the Shanghai grouping, is it really serious? Well, it's serious when Indian, Chinese, Russian military forces decide to do a joint peacekeeping operation, and they get to know each other, and they get to experience each other's presence, and maybe do they have these or don't have these options with the United States. And then, of course, is how long this lasts. Can you take personal ties between leaders, between business leaders, between leaders in movements, and do they end up enduring over time? And so just to conclude on that, I think that Devin, you'll have to do another one of these panels, and we'll just have to keep addressing the issue.
Well, in the beginning, I expressed trepidation of covering the agenda implied in this title, but we have indeed the security, economic, governance, and yes, John, environmental issues have come up, and for that we owe a big thanks to you, the audience, for your great questions, but especially to the panel. And I would say that to echo Nick, that in the year of, in the week rather, of the Oscars, in good Hollywood fashion, we will have Rise of the Rest 4 at some point. So thank you to this remarkable group.
You've been listening to an audio podcast sponsored by the Carnegie Council, the voice for ethics in international affairs. Visit us online at www.carnegiecouncil.org.